Hi, welcome to the Behind the Balance Sheet podcast, where we meet leading investors and commentators and educate ourselves about the world of investing and the world. Our mission is to remove some of the mystique around investing and improve our understanding of what makes a successful investment, or indeed an unsuccessful one. Our goal is to inform, educate, and entertain. We hope you enjoy this and every episode.
Behind the Balance Sheet and affiliates and podcast guests may own shares or have an economic interest in securities discussed in this podcast, which is aired for your education and entertainment only. Nothing in this podcast should be construed as investment advice or relied upon for investment decisions. Always do your own research.
Edelman Smithfield is a top financial communications firm. It specializes in reputation management and profile raising for financial services companies, and they work with some of the biggest names in the investment world. Every 2 years, Edelman Smithfield releases its Asset Management Brand Index. This is a quantitative ranking of the strongest brands among the 50 largest global asset managers, based on input from investment consultants and allocators. It also has a ranking of the 40 largest UK wholesale asset managers, based on input from IFAs and wealth managers. The index is designed to help asset managers think about the levers they can pull to improve their brands, to show the trends impacting their clients' perceptions, and demonstrate which firms are more successful than others in creating a positive identity. The latest index is now available. Visit edelmansmithfield.com/Asset Management Brand Index 2024 with a hyphen between each word, asset-management-brand-index-2024, to see the top line findings and request a copy. This podcast is about more than finance, and I would like to tell you about the charity we support. Duchenne UK was set up by Emily Rubin and Alex Johnson in 2012, following both of their sons being diagnosed with Duchenne muscular dystrophy. Duchenne is a progressive condition diagnosed in childhood that causes all the muscles in the body to gradually but irreversibly weaken. There is currently no cure for this disease, although there is hope. Emily and Alex set up the charity to advance treatments and care for everyone affected by the disease. Duchenne UK has tackled some of the big challenges in drug development in a search to accelerate the development of treatments, committing £18 million in the last 11 years. But they still need our support to continue their groundbreaking and life-changing work. Please play your part in helping to change the lives of both children and adults with Duchenne muscular dystrophy. Visit their website at bit.ly/btbsduch. That's bit.ly/btbs for behind the balance sheet, D for dividend, U for underperform, C for capital, H for hedge fund. Please help. Thank you. My guest today is someone I've admired for a considerable time, and I was really excited to spend an hour learning from him. Jonathan Ruffer is the founder of the eponymous $25 billion asset management firm, which has an outstanding track record. Ruffer is also a keen financial historian who talks fondly of the 1937 Stock Exchange yearbook he took away on a romantic getaway with his wife. In this episode, he explains why he thinks the yen could double, why the equities age may be behind us, why inflation is here to stay, and much, much more. If you were to meet Jonathan, other than his obvious intellect, you would never guess at his success, because he's incredibly modest. He doesn't like to be called a philanthropist, and he calls his stellar performance of over a quarter a century a fluke. But it was no accident. Jonathan is a courageous investor and yet risk-averse. And it's this apparent contradiction which might just be the key to his success. And in a first for this podcast, Jonathan turns the tables and asks me the most difficult interview question of all time. You will laugh at my pathetic answer, and I know you will enjoy this conversation. So, Jonathan, listen, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I'm very excited to talk to you. I normally start by asking people, did you always want to be an investor? And I know you trained as a, well, you started as a stockbroker, you trained as a barrister, I think, and then you went on to set up Ruffer. So tell us a bit about that.
That's right. Well, I did a lot of jobs in my 20s because I was useless at the mall. And so I was terribly good at dinner parties because whatever was mentioned, I could say, oh, yes, I've been one of those. But the truth is, looking back on my life, I always wanted to be an investor. I remember when I was about 11 coming across a book on charts and being absolutely mesmerized by the share price of Diners Club, and they were showing, you know, sort of, you know, all the movements and what you had to look out for to see whether or not the performance was going to be good. And when I was 16, I went to work for the local stockbroking firm, and the senior partner said, you know, why are you interested in working for a stockbroker? And I did recall it, but evidently I gave the reply, I rather like the idea of something for nothing. Which just caused an absolute scandal in the in this rather provincial nostril hair of North Yorkshire.
And what was the first stock you bought?
Guinness, now Diageo.
Oh, wow.
And I remember I paid 20 shillings and sixpence for it, and I sold it for 22 and threepence.
So you were a trader to start with?
I must have been, mustn't I?
Yeah. That's funny. And what happened that you went off to become a barrister? What was the rationale behind that?
I was persuaded that the theory of what made the world go round was best mediated through the understanding of law. Well, that was bollocks, wasn't true. I worked out much more slowly than I should have done. If you happen to have a talent for understanding how law works, then run with it. But it's, if you want to know the meaning of life through law, get a life.
How funny. The training, barrister training, does it have any benefits as an investor? I mean, is there anything that you think, oh, well, I kind of understand that, regulation or?
It helps one understand the way of the world. So certainly setting up a business here.
Yeah.
Just knowing how the law works is useful. So it's a parallel, really, to understanding accounting principles. You don't actually have to understand every detail of accounting to know that management accounts are quite a useful thing to have if you want to run a business.
No, absolutely. But of course, it's very important. All listeners should be very well versed. If you want to invest in equity, you should be very well versed in accounting, because obviously that's what we do, is we train people. But I always like talking to people with a long history in markets, because you have a much better perspective. And you've talked about how we've had this fantastic bull market since 1982 or whatever, not preparing people for the storms ahead. The problem, I think, is lots of even not young people, lots of even quite middle-aged people are so accustomed to the best investment being equities, they kind of have a blind faith in it. And I do a presentation on equities over a longer time frame, over the last 150 years. And if you were born in 1900, now 2000, you'd have a very different view on what equities are like. Can you just talk about that? Because you've got a long background and financial history, haven't you?
Yeah, I'm really interested in history, because it seems to me that investment is about people's behavior.
Mm.
And the history of the markets is a history of how people behave across a full kaleidoscope of events. And that's what fascinates me. And I come to this conversation thinking that we will look back on probably a couple of years ago as being the high watermark of equities. I think equities are a dying investment opportunity. Now, that isn't at all the same thing as saying I'm bearish of equities, because if you invest in a company, you can invest in different bits of the business.
Mm.
I mean, I go back to the 1920s.
Yeah.
Equities was really about ownership. If you wanted to take a business over, or you wanted to control a business, then the equity is absolutely vital. But the idea that buying 2% of a business in the stock market, that that is worth the same as the shares of the controller, is counterintuitive. That's not the way it is. I mean, if somebody owned 2% of Rafa, then I wouldn't even be nice to them. I would regard it as a coincidence. Now, why is it that equities, if you do own 2%, you control a living part of a business? I think it's the deal that was done between the management of companies and equities through stock options, that those two together, the shareholder and management, were able to see off the workers and government. Those are the four groups of people who have an interest in a pocket of prosperity.
We'll come back to the relative power of the shareholder and the manager, which is an interesting subject. But this idea that equities have been fantastic for the last 40 years, you don't think they're going to be so fantastic for the next 40 years?
No,
I'm guessing.
I think there are two answers to that single question. One is, how good an investment will it be to earn a slice of prosperity? We've had 40 years of prosperity, and I think the next move is sharply down.
Yeah.
So regardless of whether it's investment-grade bonds, whether it's private equity, whatever, I think the markets are going to be quite a dark place for an extended period of time.
Is that because you're worried about inflation, or is it because you're worried about the fact that workers are clawing back more of the pie? I mean, or do you think the valuations are high? I mean, what's your...
I think it centers around debt. I think there's too much debt. Mm. And I go rather back to nature. What's the point of winter? Winter is quite a depressing place if you're interested in the life of wildlife, because, you know, there are fewer bunny rabbits. Mm. You know, the cockroaches all die off. And you think, gosh, what a pity. Wouldn't it be nice if you could extend summer and early autumn so that lots of bunny rabbits can be happy and lots of cockroaches and lots of death watch beetles can be there? And, of course, actually what nature is demonstrating is that unless you have a cyclicality of growth and cutback, the thing becomes distorted.
Yeah.
Now, the way it becomes distorted is that the markets, the people who drive markets, want an amplified return.
Yeah.
And that's most easily achieved by debt. And it isn't simply that balance sheets are more geared than they were. You can have the equivalent of debt in behavioral terms, so that every corner is being cut, you know, just in time, I regard as a form of debt.
Yes.
You the cheaper you can supply your plum pudding to the customer, the bigger your margin and the more plum pies you'll sell. But what we can now see is that globalization was an exercise in danger, in the same way that gearing is an exercise in danger.
Interesting. I mean, I was reading Sir Tim Clark, the president of Emirates, saying that they're now sending staff to the production line at Boeing for the first time because they're really concerned about
it. I wonder
why. Is that a manifestation of what you're saying?
Absolutely.
Yeah. But one thing I was just going to ask you about on this sort of macro topic of the markets, inflation.
Mm.
I mean, you think inflation's here to stay?
I do, yeah.
Why?
I think there are two outstanding factors which make me think that the price level is not going to hold steady. And one of them we've just touched on, which is globalization.
Yes.
We're now in a world of deglobalization. And in societal terms, that has to be a good thing. I have another life up in the Northeast, and you see the advantages of having local engineering skills. You know, it means that you can get things done in the house that you wouldn't be able to do if that didn't exist. The society that I see in 20 years' time is that every nation will have all its own supply. So whether it's engineering, whether it's retail, whether it's biscuit manufacturing, that will all be done locally. Now, that is enormously expensive against even how things were 30 years ago compared with just in time. So I see that as a one-off but rolling capital cost, which will have to be paid for, and that will be paid for by inflation. But the other one is wages. Now, I start off by looking at a profit-making entity and asking myself, who owns that? Not in a legal sense or even a moral sense, but whose interests are so integrally wound up in that business that you can regard them as, to some extent, owners. Now, there are really two. The guy who owns the factory is one of them, and the guys who work in the factory are the other. So Karl Marx posited the right dynamic. It's a battle between, he called it capital and labor, and today we'd call it investors and labor. And if you go back to the Black Death in the 14th century, what you see is that this is like an arm wrestle, and it goes backwards and forwards. And the fascinating thing is, the thing that makes it a tipping point is when one or other is egregiously in charge. So I was brought up in this world in the 70s, when unions in Britain had beer and sandwiches at number 10. And if you and I started Clapham Ruffer and we were going to make underwater basket weaving equipment, and we discovered some incredible new add-on which would really make our business fly, back in the 70s, you and I would have said, well, the unions will just take that. Why should we invest capital, which is quite hard to come by, and simply see it taken by a fat and happy workforce? I don't think let's not bother. Now, that was an extreme which Thatcher, Thatcher was an instrument more than a creator of a new dynamic. And now what you can see is that certainly by the time interest rates turned, is that that move from the overwhelming power of the workforce to the overwhelming power of the investor was one of the major influences on how well the investors did, or in terms of Das Kapital, how well the capitalists did.
Yeah.
So that tells me that the workforce is, through strikes, through voting with their feet, nobody wants to be a lorry driver. They put the wages up 30% and people said, actually, I'm fed up with peeing in a lemonade bottle. I don't think I want to do it anymore. Those are the dynamics that cause inflation. So that's why I'm an inflationist. It's got nothing to do with what Jerome Powell has to say.
No, I get that. And I think you make very, very, very good points. I was going to ask you, because I can't remember whether I was reading something you'd written or listening to something an interview with you, but you were talking about taking the 1937 Stock Exchange yearbook on holiday when you'd gone off somewhere fancy with your wife. And I don't know how, whether she was so pleased about that, but you do a lot of this reading of the contemporaneous accounts. And it's quite interesting because, like, Russell Napier's stuff goes through the contemporaneous accounts. It's really fascinating to transport yourself. I've never thought of reading an old yearbook. Tell me, what do you get out of that? And if a student is listening to this podcast, how would you recommend they would go about doing that and replicating what you do?
I think if you think in terms of the spirit of an age, what is it that people are preoccupied with? What is the way that they think? What is it today we think we've invented, but actually has been there since time immemorial? And I wouldn't recommend people starting with a 1937 Stock Exchange yearbook, particularly if they've got a happy marriage. But that is the primary evidence. That's what you go back to, to see whether or not a thought is valid or not. Now, one of the things I'm really interested in at the moment is the swing away from private equity to private credit. That feels like a big shift, but it's actually no shift at all. It's the reversal, which is much wider than just in the private sector, but it's a good example of a move which we saw the other way. Do you know who I mean by George Ross Gooby?
Yes.
He was one of the heroes of the discovery of the equity market in the 1950s. He spotted that equities were a coming asset class. And given that equities in limited liability companies had existed in England since 1840, it seemed quite late for a discovery. You know, it was like sort of discovering the opposite sex when you're 37. You know, it didn't seem like an incredibly early adoption of an idea. But if you go back, if you read the yearbooks before the First World War, what you find is that really, although equities traded, they were always either speculation. So if you wanted to own gold mines in South Africa in the 1890s, then it was all done through the equity market. But if you wanted to own a decent business, you know, the brewery, for instance, deals were done in equities, but it was usually the younger son selling them to an elder cousin, because the equity was held by the families. And what traded were different gradations of debt. So at the top were debentures, because they were secured against property. And then one down that were unsecured loan stocks. And there might be five sequenced priorities in that. So if you wanted a little bit of a higher yield, you drop from the second unsecured loan stock to the fourth unsecured loan stock. So everybody was very sensitive as to the trading of these different classes of debt. And so if you were early onto Marks and Spencers, instead of saying, I've made a fortune in the equities, what you'd have bought, just because you had to, you would have bought the 8% preference stock, which would be trading at 300, so it would have a yield of 2.3. But you wouldn't be thinking to yourself, I've tripled my money. You'd be thinking, you know, I've got 8% from an incredibly safe source. So that was the way they thought.
Yes. And
you can see that it's only a very small move to say, well, let's, instead of thinking 8%, which is safer than you'd want, I'm going to try to make money in this. And actually, why don't we do it in equities? Because quite a lot of these shares have now, the families have high taxation. They've sold their controlling interest, so we might get a takeover bid. So really, all George Ross Gooby was doing was observing that in this new world, equities look more interesting. Now, what fascinates me about private equity to private credit is here are some of the sharpest people in the world investing some of the sharpest money in the world. They're saying, actually, the interesting place to be is not in the Marks and Spencer's equity. It's in the 8% preference shares. And so, in other words, in medieval terms, you didn't talk about where the value of something was. You talked about where the virtue was. And the idea that these inanimate objects had a spirit, and you wanted to know where the locus of the spirit was. And so you would say, where is the virtue? Now, I think the virtue, which moved from the fixed interest market into equities in the 1950s, and then moved into the private sector, so that, you know, David Swensson was the early adopter there. So he looked like a genius. But all he was really doing was he was an early adopter of a trend that was bigger than him and was happening outside of him. And he was just happened to be standing on the hilltop observing it. Now, I think the two things we have to look at now is what happens when the prosperity finishes and when returns go back to the fixed interest market and away from equities.
If you're right, then that is a huge shift in the way people think.
Mm. Right. And I'm not saying, I certainly don't act like I think. You know, I'm still, I feel a bit like a politician in 1938 saying war is inevitable and then going and cutting the defense expenditure.
Well, I mean, that's a massive, massive issue. Maybe come back to that. Look, your objective as a firm is to beat cash and to try not to lose money over a 12-month time frame. And the firm had a poor 2023. And I was interested to understand how you manage behavior after a setback like that, because it's really difficult to invest dispassionately when you're behind.
Mm.
And I've always found that's like the most difficult thing, because once you're behind, it's very difficult to claw it back.
Mm.
And you can't claw it back unless you take risk. But when you're behind, you don't want to take risk.
Well, I work on the basis that I've been investing the way that we are investing now, and we were a year ago when we were as smug as butter, for 40 years.
Mm.
And it worked. So the key, I think, is twofold. Is one to say, don't lose your nerve. Don't, because nobody ever says, gosh, you know, last week was so awful, I think I'm going to lose my nerve this week. What happens is people do the exact opposite of what they know is right, but tell themselves that this is an extension, this is a variation on doing it right. And in some areas, I've got a great imagination, but in this, I have no imagination. And I can taste a turd in the champagne when there's very little of it. Mm. And so I sense when there is any thinking that is different to how we have always done it. And I think the fact that our long-term record has been
fantastic.
It's ridiculous, really.
Yeah.
I don't know whether I've always said it, but what I say is that long-term performance until the end of 22 was a fluke. In other words, you can't juggle hand grenades and always get it right. I mean, it's like having 29 years of outperforming an index.
Mm.
You know, I think Miller did it for 15 years.
Yeah.
And then crashed. Well, we've done something that is probably harder than outperforming an index, and we did it really without fault for a quarter of a century. Now, that's a fluke. That's like finding the Atlantic Ocean as calm as a mill pond for a couple of years.
Yeah, no, sure.
It doesn't happen. So my feeling is that it is corporately good for us to have a proper understanding of the risks that we take. The gross book is is gross.
Yes.
If you juggle hand grenades, you know, don't be surprised that, you know, if you have a hiccup just at the wrong moment, you drop one.
Yeah.
It takes the hairs off your leg. It's funny, in my arrogant moments, Steve, I think this idea of using risk to not to lose money, which is of itself, in the narrowest sense, is counterintuitive. If you don't want to lose money, don't take risk. I say, we're going to take risk, but we're going to make our target not losing money, which is something you can do very easily by not taking risk.
Mm.
And the reason that you do this counterintuitive thing of taking risk in order not to lose money is that, by definition, if you don't lose money and you've taken risk, the overwhelming amount of time, you will make money. And it's the residual that you make. I say to people that what we're doing is playing in a market that is like a roulette table where the engineering is wonky and the croupier is drunk. The roulette wheel being wonky means you come across a situation that is misunderstood by the marketplace. And the croupier being drunk is something where if it comes right, you will do much better than you should. So if the croupier is shouting odds of 10 to 1 on black, you know, that's a great opportunity, but there's still a 50% chance you lose your money. So you can't simply invest in black and say this is the best investment opportunity I've ever seen, because there's a 50% chance you lose all your money. So the key to it is how you blend these things together. You have to understand absolutely how the markets are, but it's by juxtaposition that you do it. And I when I only looked after private clients, I used to say to them that the four assets are Queen Victoria. She's the head of the whole of the British Empire, the most powerful woman in the world, but she's also just a fat old woman. So we need some hairy Vikings to look after her. And if you have Queen Victoria and you have a force which will protect her from all comings, that's quite a good way of looking at our investments. And I look at the world today, and I'm deeply comfortable with the portfolio we've got. I was trying to think, you know, why did we have a bad 2023? And I think the biggest mistake we made was that we're very long the yen. The yen, I can't offhand, in fact, more than offhand, on hand, I can't remember a better risk reward ever than the yen is at the moment, because the central bank in Tokyo is trying to keep interest rates down because the overall level of indebtedness won't tolerate the sort of yields that there are in the rest of the world. And because the rest of the world can see that a return of 1% on your money is less than a return of 4%, arithmetic being what it is, that will simply drive the yen lower and lower until such time as it doesn't happen. And one of the things that I always look out for are people who are invested in something without having any interest in why they're invested in it. Now, in the yen, extraordinarily, there are two groups, huge groups of people who are, in one case, short of the yen, in the other case, not long of the yen. And the most interesting, the more interesting of the two, is the leverage player in America who spotted that if you want a property in Baltimore for $50 million and that costs you 5.5%, if you borrow in yen and immediately sell the yen and convert it to the dollar, you replace a high service cost for an FX problem. And he's not interested in the yen. It's simply a vehicle for getting an interest rate of 1.5% rather than 5.5%. You know, year on, he feels like he's a genius because he discovers that actually he doesn't owe $50 million anymore. He owes $45 million.
Yes.
But the key is not that he is making wrong decisions. He's not making a decision on that at all. Now, in Japan, there are institutions who are very long of treasuries and very long of European bonds. Now, they run them in the naked currencies, because although the bonds haven't been too hot recently, they've made it all back on the currency.
Yeah.
Now, let's be provocative. When the crisis comes, why is it interesting, these institutions? You've been talking to Russell Napier, you say. Well, I think Russell Napier is absolutely right on the idea that financial repression is coming.
Yeah.
I'm hoping, if I can persuade my wife, to get two dogs, and I'm going to call one of them financial and the other one repression. And that's going to be my forward-looking statement as to what's coming. But if you look at that in Japan, what does it mean? Japan's in a catch-22, because if they don't do anything, the yen just falls and falls. And if they put interest rates up, it kills the system. So it looks like they've got nowhere to go. Enter financial repression. The very rich Japanese institutions will simply be told to buy bonds at the wrong price. Now, to do that, they're going to have to sell bonds that are at the right price elsewhere.
Yeah.
And I could see the yen doubling.
Oh, really? That's interesting, because I've got some, but maybe I don't have enough. It's funny, because this...
Well, you never have enough when it's right. But I tell you, if you've got some, you've got too many.
But the last 2 months, so this podcast will go out in February. In December, we had James Aitken on, who's a macro commentator.
Oh, he's a clever chap, isn't he? I'm rather frightened of him, actually.
Oh, you know him. He's brilliant. I mean,
he's
very bullish in Japan, and he's... You know, make Japan great again is going to be the new slogan.
Yeah.
And this month, we've got Grant Williams on. Grant started life as a trader in Japanese warrants. And so he's always, and he's lived in Tokyo. He's a real expert and he's very bullish. And, you know, it seems the stock exchange is telling companies, if you're trading at a discount to book value, you've got to explain what you're doing about it. And if you don't, so there's a huge momentum behind that trade. So I'm sure you're right. It's just timing, isn't it?
If you enjoy this podcast, you're bound to enjoy our free newsletter on Substack. It's a weekly email on interesting investing topics. Visit behindthebalancesheet.com and hit the sign up button. While you're there, you might want to check out our brilliant online investor training school. Hundreds of students have taken our flagship Analyst Academy course, which teaches you everything you need to become a serious equity investor. And if you're a professional investor, we run a forensic accounting course for institutional clients, and soon a cohort-based course for serious amateurs. Email us at info@behindthebalancesheet.com.
You made a couple of comments in the past about ETFs, people tracking the index, and... Obviously, if you've owned the S&P 500, you've done fantastically well, and Warren Buffett's told you so it must be right. But you don't like index ETFs. And I had another guest in the podcast, Richard Oldfield, of Oldfield Partners, and he likened investing in an index to hanging on to the coattails of a madman. Is that your view as well?
Well, I quite recently read John Bogle's book on how he started ETFs. And I was very pleased to see that he was much more haphazard about it all. You know, the idea sort of came to him gradually. And I don't think he really understood the significance of what he'd done. And here's an example that, you know, an idea that in warm months of the idea, you know, when the markets were cheap and nobody else was doing it, the aspiration was, look, if you don't know your way around the investment market, why don't you hitch a free ride on the everybody else's wisdom? And by paying smaller fees, you're guaranteed, effectively, to be in the fourth quartile. You know, you'll never do better than that because, you know, that's, you know, all you're really saving of the fees, so you've got the median expertise at a cheaper price. Back then, you couldn't really argue with that.
No, absolutely.
But what happens is exactly what happens in nature if you don't allow winter to come on. Distortions come into it. And the idea that you can have a magnificent seven a stock market which has been created by ETF purchases, people saying, well, I just want the collected wisdom of the people who are buying the markets. You discover that what started off as wise people discerning value has become people who are wearing, you know, they're madmen who are wearing the coats that Richard has identified as hanging on to. So what we'll find is that when the markets break, the S&P will absolutely lead the way down and will go on and on and on falling because what happened in February 2000 will happen again to those stocks.
Of course.
But what will happen is the holders of ETF who have enjoyed the ride on the way up and like the Baltimore trader who's got his yen that he was the right side of. And think they're being clever in this. They'll certainly be blaming somebody else, certainly not themselves, on how much money they've lost compared with the active managers.
Yeah. No, I completely get that.
You once said that you don't have that high a hit rate. You get a lot of stocks wrong, but your winners tend to be in much bigger size than your losers. Well, why is that?
And I've wondered that too. But in fact, it came to me as a rather a surprise that. Came to me thinking, you know, how is it that we've had another decent year when I've made so many mistakes? And you'd look. And I think it had to do with having confidence in a judgment. So in other words, that I would take a lot of, in subjective terms, speculative positions. If they went wrong, that was when I would work out whether I really believed what I thought.
So you're watching the chart?
No, I've always been. I've got an encyclopedic knowledge of stocks. I show off here because they all think that, you know, I'm a bit part time, and so I'll ask them, an analyst, about a stock, and I'll say, you know, what price is it trading at, and they'll give me a figure, and I say, I haven't traded that price for a fortnight. So, you know, have another go. You know, would you think if I say you're wrong, would you guess it's higher or lower than the figure that you've mentioned? And I reckon to have most of the stocks I'm interested in within 24 hours of where it's traded. And it's not, I didn't learn them. I just knew them.
There's a natural affinity for the numbers.
Yes. And so, and I always get more interested when stocks are cheap because, you know, the only two absolutes, the price you pay for the stock and the price you sell it at. And if you buy something cheaply, even if it turns out to be cheap for a reason, at least it was cheap.
Yeah. But I was just interested in what do you do when things go wrong, when the stock starts going down? Because you've got very significant confidence in your own judgment. So you're happy to keep averaging down, or?
Well, this is a historic conversation.
Yes.
I would average down, but I now have no real contribution to make to the debate on what companies we buy. I'll sometimes come into sectors, but I leave it to...
No, I was just curious at this. Your winners tend to be bigger than your losers. I was just curious as to how you arrived at that. And there must be some part of the process you used to follow when you were picking stocks that made you just double up on the...
The answer is it's following stock prices,
right?
And so it works particularly well on companies that go on doing the same thing year after year. I mean, you know that what I never any good at was companies that morphed from being a dull company to a great company. So I would have said the winners were buying things cheaply and selling them at average or slightly above average price.
And have you ever come across people that say, oh, you should buy things and hold them forever? I'm doing a recording tomorrow with somebody that's got that philosophy that you buy the stock and you hold it forever.
Yeah.
And the winners will naturally grow and the losers will become a smaller part of the portfolio, and you just don't worry about it. You look back in 10 years.
But you don't want to be doing that after a 40-year bull market. Best avoid. That's why it looks smart, is because you're actually on a on an up escalator. So time, rather. Do you know Dimson, Elroy Dimson?
Yeah.
His book. One of the questions I ask people is, I say, 1900 to 2000, stock markets went up 200-fold in real terms. Where do you think it was at the halfway stage. You know, how much in that journey from 1 to 200? Where do you think you were in 1950? I'll ask you, where do you think it was in that?
Well, this is unfair because I'm the one that asked the question, so I've got to respond to that. So
if you're keeping the it's switched on for the answer, are you?
In 1950, it hadn't yet reached the point that it had fallen from 1929.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't have been anywhere near halfway.
It was 4. So in other words, it went from 1 to 4 in 50 years. And from 4 to 200 in the previous 50 years. And what's the difference? Well, leverage is the answer to that. But you know, a lot of people think, well, of course, you know, the two world wars, of course, must have made the first half less attractive. Well, now that might be true in Europe, but in America, the wars were hugely beneficial.
Yes.
So in other words, even with the, and the interesting thing was that the charts, I haven't got them, but I've kept them in my mind, but it's amazing how similar all the charts were. You know, it's not like the S&P is now, which is a quite different chart.
Yes.
The others.
Do you think that is sustainable? Or do you think the previous pattern where all the markets follow the same pattern is more...
Good question. Well, funny enough, you know, it's great that you asked me a question where I haven't got a set answer. But if I'm right about deglobalization, then I think there will be a tendency for them to disperse.
Yeah. Well, they've already dispersed. So, the hope is that they'll start converging again.
But you know, when I started in back in the market in 1979, what the macro guys were doing was geographical. So you know, the question was, how much did you want in America? How much did you want in Japan? And once the thing had globalized, that wasn't an interesting question anymore because it didn't really matter whether the thing was headquartered in Frankfurt or in London or in Tokyo, and one of the things I learned in those days was that the interesting question with the macro was what weight they gave Europe. Because back in the 70s, the European equity markets were really undeveloped. They were
quite small.
Quite small. And there were two funds which always jostled for last place, which had European funds. So, you know, you couldn't make any money in Europe. And what I noticed was that you know, one occasion they had 52%. One guy had 52% in Europe. And what I spotted was that he wasn't giving Europe a thought. But what he was doing was that he had 34% in America, and he was bearish America. So he'd bring that back to 28. And he'd had 17% in the UK. He was bearish at the UK. He brought that back to 11. And when he'd added them all up, it had only got to 48%. So Europe had to be 52 to get to 100. So in other words, when they were bullish, Europe became almost nothing. And when they were bearish, I used it not as the answer to the question they were trying to answer, but to their overall bullishness.
Now listen, you once said, nobody needs more than £20 million. And perhaps as a consequence of that, you applied a lot of effort to your philanthropic endeavors. You were brought up in the Northeast. You've saved the old masters in Auckland Castle, and you bought the castle and injected a lot of money into the surrounding area. Can you talk about wealth and why you've done this?
Well, first, I think a word that really makes one want to vomit is philanthropy. To me, philanthropy is what Mexican bandits do after they become presidents. So it's what you say about yourself when you need a makeover. I haven't really got an alternative word. I call it do-goodery because there's a sort of element of cynicism in that, which
yes.
I like. I just noticed that, I mean, in the world that you and I live in, we meet lots of extraordinarily rich people. And it's rather like aging. You can age in different ways. Some people get very shiny faces. Some people get very wrinkly faces. Some people dribble. Some people sing. But it's always a move from being somewhat good looking to somewhat bad looking.
Mm.
And it seems to me the effect that money has on people, you know, there are any number of ways. It makes some people arrogant, it makes some people fearful, it makes some people preoccupied. And it just seemed to me that was I didn't want that. So I treat myself I regard as a drain pipe. It comes in the top end and then pours out the bottom. So, you know, I didn't really give it a thought.
And the £20 million, where did that come from?
Oh, I had some, I said it in some article. There was I tell you who it was. It was a chap called William Rathbone IV. The Rathbones were Quaker do-gooders in Liverpool. Rathbones, the organization, is where they made their money. They were traders. They never became bankers. So they did exactly what merchant bankers do, but they were simply merchants. 70% of the tea that came to England in the 1840s was handled by Rathbones. And William Rathbone IV said no man should have more than 200,000 after that, and he'll go wrong. And I think I simply changed the number of noughts on what William Rathbone IV
said. Oh, funny. And you're from the Northeast. You now live part of the time in the Northeast?
I'm half and half, yeah.
Half and half.
I'm like Ben Hur. I have two Bloombergs. I have one up there, one down here.
How funny. And the firm has been incredibly successful. It's got, about $30 billion under management?
It's 25 from where that.
What has made it so successful? Was it you? Was it the performance? And what has been your secret? Has it been this very unconventional approach you've taken?
I think it's a number of things, but it's basically the people. The hero of this place is Henry Maxey, who joined me in 1998 as a squid dog. He got an impossibly high first in economics from Oxford, but you know, we quite quickly got over laughing at that. And I remember we worked closely together, and if I did anything good, it was holding him, because he could have really taken any job he wanted after a couple of years. But we came together for a meeting in early 2003, and we were both bubbling over with something. And we were both, it transpired, bubbling over with the same thing, that we thought that Japan was going to take off. And we absolutely worked ourselves up into a frenzy over it. And, you know, we didn't have very much money. And Fidelity Japan, which was the big investment trust, was trading at a 20% discount. And we hit it, and we got something like 15% of the company quite quickly. Mm-hmm. This was many tens of millions, which was for us a really very big deal at the time. And almost immediately, Japan took off. And so Henry and I, that was the start of us working together. Now, Henry has built up a team here, and the technical knowledge we have here is absolutely frighteningly absolute. And I call these clever clogs people who know everything about nothing. Now, I'm absolutely the other extreme. I know nothing about everything. And the key is to have these two different ways of being playing together. So the natural thing is to be like a couple of two-year-olds in the same playpen. They might appear to be playing together, but they're actually just doing their own thing. But when one can latch the two thoughts into one another, which is real oil and water stuff, because, you know, the stuff I'm interested in, I don't think I have ever read a central banker's report. I haven't got it for you, but one thing I carry around with me, just because it was so excellent, there's a letter in the FT. Yes, I've got it. How pleasing. Written by J.K. Galbraith. It's a quotation of J.K. Galbraith in his book called The Economics of Innocent Fraud, 2004. Since the U.S. Federal Reserve was founded in 1913, it has had a record against inflation and notably against recession of deep and unrelieved inconsequence. That seems to me absolutely to sum it up. So my attitude was, why bother? But I mean, I'd be jolly cross if the clever clogs tried to take that line. But for me, I get strength from not having a clue what they're saying, what the forecasts of unemployment are going to be, what the earning, whether we're going for a soft landing, a no landing. I regard it as, to all intents and purposes, unknowable. Either you do it absolutely with looking as far forward, which is no distance at all, to be ahead of everybody else by the disciplines that they produce, or you're doing what I do, which is to look over the horizon and to look in the middle ground, what's going to happen in 6 months' time. There's a killing ground.
A killing ground. That's a brilliant place for us to finish. I always like to ask people if they'd like to recommend a book to a young person thinking about coming into the industry.
Yeah.
And we're in a fantastic room surrounded by books. Sadly, not one of mine. What would you recommend to someone?
The book that I would recommend to the nerd, from a nerd, would be Sidney Homer's History of Interest Rates. And the key to it is to get the 1963 edition, because the 1977 edition, he had been badly caught out because he'd made no reference to a coming inflation. And by 1977, he'd rewritten it in the light of what had happened. But in the 1963, it's written absolutely in the innocence of how the world felt before that episode happened. Now, that's a book to match the 1937 Stock Exchange Yearbook for fascination. I don't think I've got any wisdom for what a starting book should be. There are lots of good books around, but I would go for one which was not aimed at the person who is interested in making money. You know, a lot of people in our industry, they're very hopeful that they'll make money for their clients, but what they're really interested in doing is making money for themselves.
Mm.
And I'm very struck here that we don't have a culture of being interested in making money for ourselves. And I was always useless at chatting up girls when I was young because I tried too hard. But what I noticed was the people who were good at it were the people who really were just themselves and didn't try to impress. And that was a much more successful thing. And I would have said what I didn't learn with pretty girls, I have learned.
Joylan, it's been such fun talking to you. Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, what can I say? Jonathan Ruffer is the type of investor I love talking to. Thoughtful, wise, and not afraid to be controversial. And how would you prepare for a question like the one he posed to me? Ruffer is one of my training clients, and I can tell you, they have some super smart people. And I recommend that you also take a look at the video version of this podcast on YouTube, because we filmed it in their library meeting room, and honestly, it's really worth seeing. As ever, if you enjoy this episode, please tell all your friends, and that 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or Spotify really, really helps. Thanks, as ever, for your support.